Well, I'm glad that you guys came to this talk, because I think that the German Revolution is the most important revolution in capitalist history. The fight for international socialism in the post-World War I era was settled not in Russia, but in Germany. So the newly formed worker state in Russia could only succeed if workers' revolutions were spread and won in other countries, especially in more developed economies like in Germany. The German Revolution demonstrated that the Russian Revolution was not an exceptional event, that was the result of Russia's political backwardness, completely unconnected to democratic Europe. It actually showed that workers' and soldiers' councils were able to be set up in advanced countries in very similar ways to those in Russia. But the nature of Germany also raised challenges that the Russian revolutionaries didn't have to deal with in such a complex way. In Germany, a mass social democratic party was highly embedded in workers' lives, in legal mass trade unions, and in the capitalist state. Significant strategic debates on how to challenge the hold of social democracy and win workers to a revolutionary approach emerged, debates which I think revolutionaries can still learn a lot from today. The German Revolution is a really complex and long narrative. I'm definitely not going to be talking about everything. I just want to try and draw out some of the core debates and core lessons, and there'll be plenty of time for people to weigh in on a bunch of the complexities in the discussion. So the revolution kicked off in November, where workers' councils first emerged after a sailors' rebellion that was joined by mass protests and mass strikes in city after city. And then on November 9 in Berlin, there was a mass protest joined by soldiers that completely overwhelmed the city and overwhelmed police. Workers and soldiers seized the Reichstag, the Imperial Palace, and the police headquarters and the city hall. And from the balcony of the Imperial Palace, Karl Liebknecht, who is a leading revolutionary on your screen right now, he declared the rule of capital over and called for world revolution. The situation that emerged wasn't immediately socialism. It's tragically harder than just declaring it, but instead established a situation of dual power, where two counterposed methods of running society were vying for control. So this contest for control was taking place in absolutely every single area of life. In every workplace, in the ability of the state to direct soldiers and to enforce the law. The mass organization of the workers and soldiers pointed towards a potential socialist system, but capitalism was still holding on. And one of the core groups that was helping capitalism to hold on was the Social Democratic Party, which I'll call the SPD from now on. So the SPD was previously the absolute jewel of the socialist movement. It was a party that Lenin looked up to. But they shifted towards reformist politics as German capitalism expanded and integrated the SPD into the state with politicians and trade union bureaucrats. And when the First World War began, the SPD was forced to make a clear choice between anti-war internationalism or German capitalism. And the SPD very firmly chose German capitalism. The ruling class quickly saw the value of the SPD in a revolutionary situation. A pro-capitalist party that had a following amongst the working class. And the SPD were really crucial to capitalism holding on power. They headed up the new government and they used all the tactics at their disposal to defend capitalism. So this meant that they used their weight in the workers' movement to subordinate workers' organizations to supporting just the Weimar Republic rather than fighting for anything more. And they used their position in the capitalist state to build up other methods of stopping workers' struggle, such as creating new paramilitary structures that could be used reliably to crush the working class. And these true strategies played out in the following months, with the weakness of the revolutionary left largely allowing the SPD to shape events and limit workers' self-organisation. In January 1919, the SPD put their new paramilitary to use, using it to crush an uprising in Berlin, butchering revolutionaries in a counter-revolutionary frenzy. And I think this really clearly illustrates the nature of reformism, that it's not a slower, more realistic path to socialism, but it's a firmly pro-capitalist force, which means violently stabilizing the system. And social democracy can actually do this in a more successful way than some of the other pro-capitalist forces because of its position within the working class movement. The SPD was able to take the upper hand because of its size and implantation in the working class, but they were also really greatly assisted by the weakness of other more left-wing organisations. So their main rival organisation in this period, which the radicalised working workers would join, was the USPD. So they were a real mixed bag of an organisation. A significant section of the USPD were firm reformists who just opposed some of the most appalling sellouts of the SPD and hoped to rejoin the organisation once the situation of war was over. They were really firmly opposed to workers' power. This kind of section of the party included many of their trade union bureaucrats, the party functionaries, the parliamentarians, and most of the USPD's central committee. And these figures would be willing to engage in kind of more left-wing sounding rhetoric to keep the radicalising workers on board, but it was just that, rhetoric. But there was a genuinely more left-wing section of the party. So members and a small section of the leadership were in flux, moving towards revolutionary ideas, but in a partial or confused way. So these workers were motivated by a hostility to the horrors of the First World War, which was really having this huge impact on the working class in Germany becoming more unpopular. They were inspired by the shining example of the Russian Revolution, and they supported Soviets in Germany, but they didn't necessarily have a clear sense of what this meant and how the reformist ideas of the SPD and within the USPD were completely hostile to this project. So this made the USPD a centrist party, which is not something that we're familiar with today. I'm not talking about the centrism of like Hillary Clinton or something. I'm talking about centrism in a revolutionary situation, a short-term phenomenon that straddles the line between revolutionary politics and reformist politics. And this makes them completely incapable of providing a clear lead in a revolutionary situation. So the USPD responded to the November Revolution by ceding to the SPD's core strategy. So they joined the SPD government, which was the public face of the new capitalist state, and they supported subordinating the workers' organisation to this government. And this is unsurprising when much of the USPD was politically not in favour of workers' councils smashing the capitalist state or even having more political and economic power than the Council of People's Deputies. And many of their kind of core members argue this explicitly, so most notably Kautsky in the debate with Lenin. So there was a more left-wing section of the USPD. They would push for a little more independent organisation of the workers, a little bit more democracy, a little bit more oversight over the council, and would verbally support workers' power. But they would typically cede when they were challenged by the USPD right or the SPD. So the USP left made concession after concession in this period. So they backed down on forming a Red Guard. They handed authority over economic questions to the trade unions, which is a real gift to the conservative trade union bureaucracy that was largely under the control of the SPD. So this all really helped the SPD to shape the events in the early period of the revolution and limit the capacity of workers' and soldiers' councils. So the position of the SPD as entrenched in the capitalist state and central to the counter-revolution put the reformists more immediately as the enemies of the revolution, while at the time having the majority support within the working class and soldiers' organisations. So this situation is very different to what was going on in Russia, where the unions were not as established and bureaucratised, and the provisional government wasn't headed up by a social democrat, it was headed up by a prince. So in the early stages of a revolution where workers are thrown into struggle and their ideas can change really quickly, this can make them open to revolutionary politics, but in an uneven way. And one of the ideas that can really dominate workers in the early stage is one of unity. And this obviously has a whole series of good dynamics. We do want the working class to be united, but it's a real problem in Germany in particular when it's used as a barrier to criticising other working class organisations. And that includes the SPD that's really at the forefront of defending the system. And the SPD were able to weaponize this in a really clear way, using their organizational strength within the workers and soldiers councils and within the trade union movement. I think all of this shaped the political habits of the more radical section of the working class movement and laid the basis for an ultra-left response to much of this. So ultra-leftism, I think, is an approach to politics which doesn't win over the broader layers of workers and instead valorizes the actions of a minority. So there's a section of the German left that becomes tied to this and has consistent ultra-left theories and strategies. But I think in this early stage of the revolution, it's largely just spontaneously emerging from communists being carried away by the situation. So not understanding what's possible in a political situation, what will take things forward, what would be an isolated action. And I think these dynamics exist in every revolution, and so therefore does ultra-leftism. But ultra-leftism in Germany was much bigger and became more theoretically hardened throughout the revolution because of the nature of German capitalism, the strength of the SPD, and the weakness of revolutionary organization. Ultra-leftism generally involves a couple of different tendencies. So I think abstentionism and adventurism are some of the two main ones. So abstentionism, in particular, towards the reformist institutions, so refusal to participate in trade unions, which cuts them off from the reformist workers who are still inside those institutions, and adventurism, so the actions of a radical minority that isolate them off from the broader working class movement rather than pushing the struggle forward. The Communist Party of Germany was deeply influenced by ultra-left politics from its foundation at the end of 1919, and pursued both abstentionism and adventurism at different points. So you'll see here the Communist Party was formed in the midst of a revolutionary movement. At the start of the KPD's foundation, a really large proportion of its membership were young, politically raw, and impatient to make the workers' revolution. And until they merged with the USPD left in late 1920, they were very small and based largely in radical street protest rather than the workplace. So this limited their ability to intervene into workplace debates and meant they had less experience and legitimacy in leading the most militant and industrially significant sections of the working class. At their founding conference, most members ruled out work in the trade unions and in any form of parliamentary politics, which they associated with the betrayals of the SPD. And the abstentionist approach was accompanied by an argument for the immediate smashing of the National Assembly. So one of the ultra-lefts kind of arguing in this conference said, we'll establish the new government in Berlin, we've got a fortnight, which is obviously very grandiose in this point of the revolution. The party's first foray into adventurism in a really substantial way was January 1919, with a premature uprising that led to severe repression of the party and the murder of its most capable leaders. A section of the KPD, including Karl Liebknecht, participated in a revolutionary committee with the aim of throwing the Ebert government with the USPD. And this was despite the KPD Central Committee being wary of provocation and deciding that a defensive approach was needed in this situation. And it was an interesting situation because there was actually an overreach from the SPD that really angered workers who were mobilising out in force. But while the workers were willing to mobilise to defend against an attack on the working class organisation, this was a very different a set of politics than being willing to overthrow the SPD-headed government. The workers were not organisationally ready or politically convinced of the need to do this. And again, you think about that preference for unity in the early stage of the revolution that meant that many workers in Berlin were unwilling to participate in something that they viewed as a socialist kind of squabble between these different factions. And that's to say nothing of the broader situation in Germany outside of the situation in Berlin. The Revolutionary Committee was also largely dominated by the USPD, which a party had, which had repeatedly clarified that they weren't for workers' power. So in practice, Karl Liebknecht backed a body that was guaranteed to completely mislead the situation in a moment that wasn't at all ready for workers' power. So this Revolutionary Committee pressed forward, was met with violence, the USPD government ministers directed their newly formed military organizations, paramilitaries, to push back the revolutionaries and to launch a broader counter-revolutionary campaign of violence, murdering communists, including Luxembourg and Liebknecht. So ultra-leftism continued to be an issue within the Communist Party and meant that communists missed opportunities to push back reformism and lead mass resistance. So in March 1920, when there was an attempted military coup, a general strike was called, and this was actually initiated by a right-wing SPD trade union bureaucrat and signed onto by USPD and SPD leaders. The strike spread across the whole country and targeted not just the coup attempts, but also the armed apparatus, which had been built up since the revolution started. The response from communist leaders in Berlin was to stand aside and to declare neutrality in the fight between, and I quote, two counter-revolutionary wings, and to declare that the working class was too weak to fight in this moment. Once it became clear that the strikes were a growing success, they supported them and tried to distinguish themselves from the other socialist groups through verbal attacks on the USP leaders, rather than trying to lead in practice or to give concrete slogans to the movement that would take the struggle forwards. This experience, I think, shows many things. I think it shows some of the problems with abstentionism, but I think it also shows that the SPD is still a significant part of the workers' movement, even even as they're in the state, and even after they've directed counter-revolutionary violence. And ultra-left tactics are not enough to defeat them. Communists need to be able to engage with reformist workers in mass action and win them in practice. The most lunatic instance of ultra-leftism took place a year later, and it was based on a much more theorized out version of ultra-leftism. So this was based on the theory of the offensive, which argued that the party should take an offensive approach regardless of the state of class struggle. And this approach would force the pace of the revolution. Here we are. So the KPD papers encouraged party members to stockpile arms and issued a call for a general strike that the vast majority of the working class didn't support. Party members were encouraged to start brawls with workers who disobeyed the orders of the party, who they even called scabs. Not even all members of the KPD took part in this attempted general strike. The demonstrations called by the party in Berlin mobilized less than 10,000 workers when they previously had won over 200,000 votes in trade union elections in the area. And this led to the repression and further isolation of the KPD from the organized working class. Hundreds of thousands of members of the party left. And this quote that I have on the slide, it's worth noting, this is actually after the march action. So they still haven't drawn the conclusions that this thing was a total disaster. They're arguing this in April after that, that action. So these examples show, I think, that ultra-leftism is both abstentionist and adventurous. And these might seem counterposed, but actually they fit very well together. I think both misunderstand the ongoing hold of reformist ideas within the working class, which won't be overcome overnight, despite the SPD's really disastrous role in the revolution. And both abstentionism and adventurism valorize the actions or arguments of a minority as the method to overcome this. This can easily shape a political organization that is less experienced, that is less embedded within the working class organizations, and that is furious with betrayals of the SPD. But it fails to defeat reformist organization and is unable to win over reformist workers in practice. So the tactic that was argued by revolutionaries to do this in practice was the United Front. This was carried out many times sort of between the ultra-left disasters that I've talked about. I've sort of grouped all the ultra-left things together, but it's worth saying, you know, there's instances of United Front actions before the disastrous periods of ultra-leftism. So, for instance, in January 1921, before the March action, they are doing sensible, you know, good United Front work. It's not like they were a total ultra-left disaster before then. But in the period after the March action, they are forced to more clearly clarify their position and more clearly take up the policy of the United Front as an orientation, kind of assisted by the Comintern at the Third Congress that happens in the middle of 1921. So the United Front was about engaging broader layers of workers in struggle, appealing to social democratic leaders for common action around certain defensive partial demands. The point of this isn't unity. Being in a separate revolutionary organization is a necessary precursor to the United Front. The United Front is actually about fighting alongside workers who aren't already communists in order to show them in practice that the communists are more consistent fighters for the working class and to push the working class struggle forward. So this was the party's orientation after they'd learnt some of the lessons from the March action, which again, I say they had to be very assisted by the Comintern's intervention, and by themselves, they were still sort of declaring it a victory. The party was able to recover from the disaster of the March action. They were able to grow its membership. And this was partially by winning over workers in the SPD through the United Front strategy. So the KPD initiated joint action with the SPD and unions in a number of different circumstances. One of them was after fascists assassinated a moderate Jewish politician. The KPD raised demands of disarming the right-wing paramilitaries, the formation of armed workers' militias, and joint action against inflation. The KPD also built significantly within the factory councils in this period, and this involved many SPD members. They were able to use the factory councils to establish further initiatives around inflation and unemployment. And they had to be willing at points to move forward without the SPD's support. So it shows that United Front is not just some easy thing that you can just apply to every single situation, but they were able to pull along SPD members with them in these working class struggles. So in 1923, the political situation really significantly changes and it requires new tactics. Germany is in a severe state of crisis with runaway inflation, the French occupation of the Ruhr, and the impoverishment of the petty bourgeoisie. And this crisis has a really significant impact on working class organization. The trade unions are in a state of collapse, their finances disappear, and they respond with passivity. And the factory councils, which the KPD had a really huge influence within, were able to take the lead, setting up control committees to organise against price rises, workers' militias to set up a riot, and new forms of national organisation through the factory councils as well. The KPD initially responds quite slowly to the situation, but they begin to reorient, understanding it as a revolutionary situation and calling an insurrection. And I'm not going to be able to go into all of the problems with the exact way that they went about calling this insurrection. There's a whole number of issues, but I think a pretty central one is that they relied on the SPD left to support it and they called it off when they didn't. And this defeat is a really significant turning point. In Germany, the far right begins to grow significantly while the workers' movement is on the decline. In Russia, socialism in one country begins to be raised and revolutionary internationalism is ditched in favour of counter-revolutionary politics, which transforms not only Russia, but communist parties around the world. And there's a whole number of conclusions that can be drawn from this political moment and the defeat of the German Revolution. A really common one is blaming the workers themselves and rejecting the possibility of workers' power in an advanced capitalist state like Germany. And this conclusion is actually shared by conservative historians, but also by some of the ultra-lefts who argue that there wasn't really a revolutionary situation in Germany. So Anton Panikowicz, who's an ultra-left and associated with the KAPD, an ultra-left party in Germany, he argues that workers' spiritual development was lacking and that a real revolution was a long way off. And this is, I think, one way of justifying the total marginality of the ultra-left organization. But many other people have argued this to say that the Russian model has absolutely nothing to do with the advanced capitalist countries and that revolutions are always bound to fail in the West. But I think that the German Revolution did establish elements of workers' control. It established workers' councils, workers' militias, and factory councils. And it showed that the Communist Party could win mass support. The problem wasn't the capacity of the working class to organize or their ability to be won to revolutionary politics. I think instead the gap in Germany was a party able to lead the working class, both in 1923 during the height of the revolutionary movement, but also throughout the whole revolutionary process. The nature of Germany as an advanced capitalist country didn't make revolutionary organizing impossible. It made it more important. As Reformism was a mass force embedded in the state and in the working class, a really clear revolutionary organization was needed to win working class people away from reformist ideas and organization. And the KPD was severely limited in this by their small scale, by their small size, by their lack of experience. They ultimately failed to consistently analyze the political situation and to adopt appropriate tactics based on this to figure out when to retreat and when to move forward boldly. They were too often passive or adventurous, making it much easier for capitalism to hold on in Germany, which left the workers' state in Russia isolated and a victim to counter-revolution there as well. I'll leave it there.